Yeah, there was times on a Monday morning when I'd be sitting in my car in the car park, afraid to go into the video review because I knew what was coming my way, because I knew he was always going to pick on me. And it was unbelievably difficult.
Did you ever think about walking away from it?
No.
Probably Ireland's greatest fullback ever. That's how Rob Kearney was described by his monster rival and international rugby teammate, Alan Quinlan. Now, whatever about that probably bit, Rob Kearney is certainly the most decorated Irish fullback. 95 caps, 2 Six Nations Grand Slams, as well as 2 other Triple Crowns, 4 European titles with Leinster, 2 Lions Tours, and European Player of the Year in 2012. Rob Kearney, it's great to have you on the Insights podcast. Thank you indeed for coming in.
Sean, it's great to be here.
Good stuff. You've had a bit of time, Rob, to adjust to life after professional rugby. You talked at the time you left about needing to be patient as you looked for a new sense of purpose, something or things you could be passionate about. So how are things now? Have you found that something?
I'm certainly a lot further along the track. I think when you say, you know, been patient coming out of something like that, it takes time, a long time. I think the biggest thing for me was, you know, since I was the age of 4 or 5, the only thing I wanted to do was play rugby. So you have such a strong sense of purpose every single day, getting out of bed and wanting to do something, having a goal to go, a place that you want to go. And that's, in some ways, I consider myself blessed to have been given that from such a young age. Very lucky to have been able to lived out that dream, because of course there's so many kids who dream of playing rugby for their country or soccer or whatever it is. So to be able to do that for such a long period of time was incredible.
But from the age of 5, I mean, that was you were definitely an early starter there, were you?
I was an early starter, and it was the old Lansdowne Road. I'll never forget my dad taking me to the game, and we were up in the stands looking down, and I turned to him and I said, someday I'll be out there. And he was always amazing. He was incredible. You know, in terms of you can do whatever you want to do, dream big, don't ever settle. And I think it's really important for parents to instill that in their children.
Did he take you to Lansdowne Road as a 5-year-old?
I think so. And I don't know how I got a ticket for that game, because they were scarce enough back
then.
Those
are the days when you could lift a kid over the stiles.
I know. Now, maybe I was sitting on his lap, or my memory of it isn't that perfect.
Can you remember who was playing? Ireland versus?
It was a Five Nations game. So it wouldn't have been England or France, because those tickets would have been a lot more scarce.
Yeah, so, like the way hurlers talk about having been born with a hurl in their hand. I mean, were you attached to a rugby ball from an early age?
Yeah, I was. And there was times I used to go to bed with a rugby ball, holding it. So there was no teddies. It's a rugby ball. You know, I grew up in the Cooley Peninsula, and rugby wasn't that big there. My dad played a lot of rugby with Dundalk, and he was very active and involved in the club there. So that's where I got my little bit of exposure to rugby. Gaelic football, obviously, was the biggest sport that I played growing up. It was on my doorstep, played it every second night of the week. But I don't know what it was about rugby that kept drawing me back to that sport.
You made the Irish full-back position your own for probably, what, 10 years? I mean, it was yours, provided you weren't injured, and there were injuries, which we can talk about. I was talking to one of your former teammates, and not Alan Quinlan, who said, look, if you had to throw a child out of the top story of a burning building, the person he'd want on the ground to catch it would be you. I don't know if you could have perhaps hazard a guess who that might have been, but it's quite the compliment. In other words, you were so reliable. You were the rugby equivalent of, well, Bobby Moore of England, the England captain from 66, they said. He was always there. And so were you.
Yeah, listen, it was my biggest strength on a rugby field. And the role of the fullback, that's probably the one remit that you have to be able to do. You know, when the ball goes up in the air, you have to claim it. That has to be yours. You know, so you have a responsibility for your team. You know, it can be lonely back there sometimes. You know, the 14 guys in front of you, you're always looking at them. And in the forwards, they can have their buddy a meter or two beside them. It's lonely back there. And I always sort of, I liked that. I don't know if it was the little bit of swagger in me as a young kid. You know, I sort of always liked to stand out a little bit. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Who are the potential, if you like, culprits of an observation like that? Could it be anybody?
It could be anybody. Yeah. Donegh O'Callaghan was always a man who...
Okay, you only needed the one guess. And something else he said just about, you know, playing international rugby, and I don't know if you would identify with this, but what he misses most, or what he missed most having retired from rugby, was the brutally honest exchanges with teammates and colleagues in the dressing room. Do you identify with that?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. And I think it's the biggest single thing that sport has over any other walk of life. And you speak to so many business people and they're always so intrigued about what is it so special that these great sport teams have, and what is it about their culture that we can try and bring into our walk of life. And it's really difficult for them to bring those parallels together. But there's something unbelievably powerful in a sports dressing room or an analysis room where I can say to you exactly what I'm thinking and you don't take it to heart and you go away and you work on it because you know that I'm only saying it for the betterment of the team and you're taking it on board because you want the team to be better. And it's this overriding concept that everyone is there for the greater good.
But you'd need to develop a fairly thick skin, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you do. You absolutely do. And if you don't have a very thick skin, there's a chance that you won't survive in that profession. You know, so you it comes with the territory over it, and you can develop that as years go on. And there's definitely things said to me that I absolutely took to heart, that I was very offended by them, but you just learn to move on and get on with it.
We'll talk about particularly, you know, Michael Checa in your early days. You were a youngster coming into the Leinster squad and you said you bore the brunt of criticism from him. But are you talking about things said to you personally by other players?
Sometimes by players, yeah. Mostly by coaches. And, you know, you mentioned Michael Checa there, and he was the one guy who went hard at me. He was very much from, you know, a Knoll school Aussie background where the younger players coming into a group, they have to learn their trade. It's like an apprenticeship. You come up the hard way, you get treated harder than everyone else. And I think that style of coaching, that style of leadership and management has gone now.
Yeah, you said that as Leinster coach when you came in of Michael Checa, behind the gruff exterior was a gruff interior. And you talked, as I say, about you being at the getting the brunt of his criticism, and that, you know, there were people like Gordon Darcy, Brian O'Driscoll and Jamie Heaslip. They were his mates. Now, you saw that happening. You must have felt very aggrieved, and maybe kind of, did you feel a bit abandoned by those guys, that they might have maybe made life a bit easier for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you look at the Leinster setup now, for example, when a young guy comes in, the senior players want to do everything they can to make that person feel as included as quickly as possible. Give them the best opportunity every day to be the best version of themselves, because it's not easy for a young guy coming in. And the culture was it was pretty rotten back then. And, you know, Checa had his hierarchy within his team, his star players, his older, more experienced ones, that he probably felt that if I can stay close to these guys, well, then I've got the backing of the hierarchy within the group. And that's not the way to coach a team. And, you know, there was times on a Monday morning when I'd be sitting in my car in the car park, afraid to go into the video review, because I knew what was coming my way, because I knew he was always going to pick on me. And it was unbelievably difficult.
Did you ever think about walking away from it?
No. No. Now, there was times when I thought about not going in on that particular day. And there was other players at that time who could have made a life in professional rugby, but just weren't able to stick at it, to stick with it. Maybe this was his coaching philosophy in terms of he didn't want those players in his squad that weren't able to deal with that emotional pressure.
What sustained you, though? I mean, what kept you going?
I think it was just an inner grit, an inner desire. Maybe that dream that I had as a kid was so strong and so prominent that nothing and nobody was going to stop me from achieving it.
And from his point of view, I suppose, there was that imperative that he get some success for Leinster. And there was a sense out there, rightly or wrongly, that Leinster weren't as tough as Munster, that Munster had won more silverware. And he needed he needed to do something about it.
Yeah, and he did. So we have to give him a huge amount of credit for that. And I always do give him a huge amount of credit. Leinster were a soft team at the time, filled with stars, filled with great players who could win silverware, but just weren't able to get the job done. You know, he needed to instill that inner grit and bite in his team. And our neighbours only down the road were doing this, and they had everything that we did. They had trophies, they had the grit, they had the great squad. And it was really difficult growing up in a Leinster team at that time when the rivalry was so strong and you're seeing your arch rival be that successful.
Everything changed on a famous day in Croke Park. I think it was the Heineken Cup semi-final 2009. And the standout memory from that is Johnny Sexton standing over Ronan O'Gara, bellowing at him, and Leinster won and went on to win the Heineken Cup. I mean, you'd wonder how guys, and they obviously did become friends and colleagues afterwards, but I mean, that must have been something to observe, in your case, from a distance because of injury at the time.
Yeah, it was. Now, if I take you back a few years before that, semi-final of the Heineken Cup in 2006 or seven, I think it was six, we played Munster in the semi-final in Lansdowne Road, as it was at the time. It was a home semi-final for Leinster, and there was 80% red in the stadium. And I think that was the biggest wake-up call for us as a team, as a province, the business people within the organization. I think we all had to really step back then and say, hold on a second, what's going on here? And how are we playing a home semi-final and there's 80% Munster people here? And there was a real eureka moment for the squad, players, coaches, everybody. And then you fast forward to 3 years' time, and I think that's when everything turned on its head for Leinster as a team, and has now made them one of the most successful teams in the world.
To the point where your Munster friends are looking at them and saying, look, you know, and they've been making progress on this in the last year or so, but what do we need now to do to catch up?
Yeah, and listen, despite that enormous rivalry that was there, you know, we were jealous of them. We were in huge admiration of them. We were in awe of what they could do as a team. And they single-handedly drove us on. You know, they were the catalyst for us getting better. And these things are always cyclical. You know, teams go up and down. They stay at the top. They move down. And it's Munster now for a number of years who haven't been able to get back to those heights. And they will be using Leinster's success as their motivation the same way we did.
And on a related aspect to this, Rob, I mean, it's part of Irish rugby folklore now, and it's been well aired, and it's in your book and it's in other people's books as well. The Irish camp in Enfield in 2008, and you were still fairly new to the national squad, and you raised an issue, which I think in your book with David Walsh, you say has grown hairy legs ever since. But it's not that you questioned whether the Munster guys had the same commitment to Ireland as they had to Munster, but you saw something there that you felt needed an airing.
The whole country saw something there. You know, this was the rugby elephant in the room across the board. And, you know, huge amounts of credit has to... Declan Kidney pulled me aside the night before. And I didn't even have 10 caps at the time. I was 22 years of age. So I was a pup in the eyes of some of these boys. And Declan pulled me aside the night before and he said, we're going to have a big meeting tomorrow, air all our airs and graces. And he looked at me and said, who was the captain of the Ireland under-19s last year? I said, yeah, I was. And he said, well, you were captain because you were a leader and you had a voice. And I want you to have that tomorrow. He says, I want you to say whatever you want to say. So he teed me up a little bit for it, but it was incredible man management from him. That was his gift as a coach. So then the next day came around and we were all broken off into our different groups in terms of discussion, kind of like a SWOT analysis, our strengths, weaknesses, where can we get better? What are some of the issues? And it was very clear and obvious at the time, everyone was speaking about how this Munster team had something that the Irish team didn't. The Irish team at the time was littered with Munster players, you know, from number 1 to 10 almost. I remember saying in that meeting that what was going on in Thomond Park was unbelievably different to what was happening in the National Stadium. You know, how these players played, the passion they showed, the crowd. When opposition teams came to Thomond Park back then, they were 10 points down on the scoreboard before the game even started. And I was enthralled by this. Like, I was couldn't understand why the national team didn't have this. So I said it in the meeting. I said, there's something not right with what is happening with this Munster team in Thomond Park and why it's not directly translating into the national team. And that was fine. And okay, it was written down on the piece of paper. And then half an hour later, the whole group came back in together. And Ron O'Gara, who was the leader of our group, taking all the notes at the time, read out 10, 15 bullet points. And then Marcus Horan stepped up and he said, you know, I take real exception to that comment. And Decky's sitting in the corner. He is loving this now that everything is out on the table and we're probably getting under the bonnet of some of the issues. So there was the silence, and I was hoping that Ronan, as our team leader, was going to jump in for me and say, you know, I was one of the people in our group and I think what he meant by this, but he didn't. So the silence went on more and more. And I just said to myself, I can't let the silence go on anymore. I've said this in a smaller group. I have to be man enough now and say it in front of the whole group. So I got up and I said the same story to the group again. And there was a little bit more silence. And then there was a small discussion around it. And I don't even actually remember the subsequent discussion after that, because I was so nervous that now the whole squad, everyone knows that I have questioned the Munster players, their culture, their heritage, and asked a direct question is, why can't this be done for Ireland? You know, it has grown a little bit of leg since then. I think the fact that we went on to win the Grand Slam after that, it sometimes was pinpointed as being a little bit of a turning point. But what I always say is that had we got the wooden spoon that year, would I then become the villain of Irish rugby and the reason for its downfall? You know, the Munster players took it unbelievably well. And I remember going to breakfast the next morning. I didn't sleep that night. I was in fear of what was going to be said to me the next day. Have I damaged these relationships with my hopeful teammates for the next 10 years? How are they going to take it? And it was Donegh O'Callaghan who pulled me aside before we went into the breakfast room, and he said, fair play. You have a massive pair of gahoonies on you for saying that, and it needed to be said. And we moved on from there.
And you subsequently became very close personally and formed deep friendships with particularly some of the Munster guys. I'm thinking of Donegh O'Callaghan, one, and he speaks so highly of you and writes and has written so highly about you and what you bring, and people like Conor Murray as well.
Yeah, you know, there's two separate sort of eras. You know, you go back to 2009 era under Decky, the Munster and Leinster players didn't really have that much of a relationship together. You know, you go into dinner, the Munster lads are at one table, Leinster lads at another table. There was no deep desire to build those relationships and work on them. And then it did happen over time. And, you know, some of the players in that team were some of the best teammates that you could ask for. You know, Donegh, an unbelievable teammate. Paul O'Connell, these guys would do anything for you.
Meanwhile, you know, you had to build relationships with some of your Leinster colleagues who basically left you out to dry. People like O'Driscoll and Jamie Heaslip, you know, when you were getting it in the neck from Michael Checker.
Yeah, well, Jamie was sort of a little bit different because he came in at the same time to me. We were the two young kids coming into the squad. As I earn my stripes a little bit more within Leinster, and I'm sure I probably had a little bit of maturing to do in terms of the right way and the correct way to behave in that environment. But, you know, I won those guys over after time, and then you start putting in good performance for Leinster and good performance for Ireland, and you work on those relationships and you build them up a little bit more of a closer bond. But it did take time. Declan was great. He was a coach who I really needed at that time in my career. You know, I was struggling with Michael Checa, his way of coaching. And Declan was a coach who put his arm around you, made you feel special, made you feel important. And I was at a period in my life when that was something that I really needed.
And fast forward a bit as well, along comes Joe Schmidt at Leinster. I think it was about 2010. And that seems to have been a bit of an ordeal for you as well, not in Leinster and then subsequently with Ireland.
Yeah, Joe was an amazing coach. And I think he will always go down as Ireland's most successful coach in terms of the silverware that he's won for both province and country, how much he's developed the team, not just on the field, but in terms of our psyche as a rugby nation. The first coach to beat New Zealand numerous times, South Africa, he brought a winning mentality to this team. That every time this Irish team now takes the field, we expect them to win regardless of the opposition. And he was a key driver behind that.
To the outside world, he could be very charming. We saw him several times, I think, on the Late Late Show. I had the privilege of interviewing him just before he took up the Ireland job. But you say, you know, you could be disemboweled by Joe Schmidt in 15 or 20 seconds. That felt like forever.
He was a ruthless coach. He was the ultimate perfectionist, where if you were a beat off in terms of what he wanted you to do, you'd get two barrels between the eyes. And it was difficult at times to work under him, to work in that sort of regime. Constant stress, constant pressure, anxiety put on you from Monday to Friday, that sometimes when the game came around, it was the easier part of the week. But that was a big thing within his coaching philosophy, that he wanted to put players under the most extreme of pressure from Monday to the Friday. So when Saturday came around, that was almost the easy part.
You would have spent a lot of time in camp, particularly with the Irish squad, in the lap of luxury down there in County Kildare. But it sounds like boot camp more than anything else.
It was definitely a boot camp back then. It was, and it was difficult. There was times when you would be mentally exhausted from it, as opposed to just the physical exhaustion. But we knew that he was probably the best coach in the world. We knew that he was bringing us an enormous amount of success as a team. And I think when you look back on periods of a Six Nations, okay, they might not have been the most enjoyable times, but you've got a medal in your back pocket. That's the bottom line. You just want to win, and you go through whatever you have to go through. You'll take whatever stresses and pressures the coach puts you under to get those medals. There was an element of us not knowing any different. We thought if we want to win and if we want to be successful, this is how the environment has to be. Now, subsequently, when you look at Andy Farrell and his reign and what he's done with this team, I think everyone realizes now that there's many different ways to skin a cat.
Okay, you weren't there for it, and I think you got your P45 from Andy Farrell shortly after the 2019 World Cup. But from, obviously, you're in contact with people, you've got friends still playing and so forth. I mean, it sounds like it's a happier camp.
I think these guys prefer spending time in camp than they do at home with their families. They love going in there. They have a smile on their face every day. By all accounts, it's very, very different to the camp that Joe had. And I think that's, you know, Andy Farrell was lucky to have worked for 4 or 5 years under Joe. And I'm sure he learned an enormous amount as a coach. And he might not be the coach he is today without some of those experiences. But he was very smart and clever enough to be able to understand the things that Joe was doing that were working and the things that Joe was doing that weren't working. And he was able to change those.
Was there nobody who was in a position to say to Joe Schmidt, listen, you know, we have huge respect for you, but do you really need to be as on top of these guys as you are?
Those conversations might have happened, but his rebuttal would be, well, do you want to win or do you want to lose? And the answer was always, we want to win.
So how would you, in a sentence, describe his reign in terms of just the atmosphere in the group?
Over the course of his career? I think Ireland's most successful rugby coach that created an environment that was exhaustingly difficult to work and to play in, but was ultimately successful.
Would it be too much to describe it as a reign of terror?
Some people would have felt it was a reign of terror.
Did you?
No, I loved working for him. I really did. I loved having a coach who had 100% clarity in terms of exactly what I want you to do. If you do this, you get picked every week.
Did you feel, though, in any way that maybe your style was cramped, that you might have wanted to do things with the ball, but that you knew he'd be down on you like a ton of bricks?
Yeah, sometimes there was those elements of a little bit of freedom being taken from you. But then it comes back to, you know, every Monday morning, what is your goal for the week? To get picked on the team on Saturday, to play for my country. And you'll do anything in order for that to happen. So I wasn't going to compromise on a few little things that I might wanted. And that's why I say I love playing for him, because he was crystal clear. Do this, do it right, do it as I ask of you, and you get picked. And there's something very nice in that too. And some players weren't able for it, and others were. But that sense of extreme clarity was something that I craved.
Which I suppose is a good moment, Rob, to talk a little bit about the mental pressure on players. I mean, we saw in that recent, I don't know if you've seen it, the Netflix series Full Contact, Andrew Porter just, you know, being quite honest and open about the mental stresses that he's had. I mean, this kind of predates his rugby career. But is that something, and just bearing in mind what you said about some of the Leinster guys earlier on, that maybe the people who run rugby need to be more aware, or maybe are they more aware about it now, just taking care of people in the round?
Listen, I don't think, you know, Andrew Porter is an amazing man in terms of what he has had to go through in his life. He's had a huge amount of obstacles that he's had to overcome and has shown incredible bravery now to come out and to speak about them. You know, rugby players, sports people, they're no different to anyone else. They're still the exact same human beings as the ones you walk back and past on the street. So, you know, every rugby player, every sports person has their own issues. They have their own ups and downs. They have their own mental battle with confidence, how to deal with setbacks, all of those things. So I think just because you're in sport doesn't make you any different. So I don't think the governing bodies, the people who run rugby, have to be any more mindful of it. You know, they're just normal people with the same everyday problems.
I know, but when you were personally under stress because maybe, you know, you might have had a bad game, or because you felt you were getting it too much in the neck from the coaches, did you have somewhere to turn?
It's a stressful environment, Sean. You know, it's not made for everyone. And, you know, there's so many people who have all the ability, but they can't just get there because they don't have the top 6 inches. So yeah. There was times when I was absolutely down and out, when you question what you're doing. Am I still able to do this? Do you have people to turn to? Yeah, you have your family, but they're always going to be a little bit biased to you. Do you turn to the coach? Not really, because you don't want him to see that little bit of vulnerability in you, and you're starting to question yourselves. Do you turn to your teammates? Sometimes you might, but they've got their own issues going on too, and they're just concerned about getting themselves right. So a lot of the time it's just you and your own thoughts and you having to overcome them. And I think the more setbacks you overcome, be it with injury, with form, with selection, with what you read in the newspaper, you know, every time you come over one of those things, I always felt that you just add another layer of resilience to who you are as a person.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger,
too. Well, it's true.
Borrow a phrase.
It's true.
When we were chatting before, you went through a list of people who had played at fullback, I think, for Ireland when you were unavailable due to injuries or whatever you mentioned. I think about 9 of them: Jordan Murphy, Girvan Dempsey, Gavin Duffy, Luke Fitzgerald, Felix Jones, Jared Payne, Tiernan O'Halloran, Simon Zebo, and Jordan Larmour. But yet, you know, you kind of own, when you were fit and not dealing with injuries, you kind of owned that position, didn't you? And you didn't have, like, you didn't need to be insecure about it, or you didn't have any individual bearing down on you competitively, did you, for selection, as we'll say Ronan O'Gara did when Johnny Sexton showed up?
No, I was lucky like that. You know, when Tuesday evening came around, team selection, for 95% of my career, I was never sitting in that chair overly nervous about what the coach was going to say. And there was times when I knew selection was 50-50 and it was exhausting. You know, I don't know how players go through their whole career dealing with that moment of truth when the coach names out the team. So, you know, I always seem to have been, you know, nailed on for that jersey. But then, you know, there's, I suppose, as a coach, particularly Joe, he always had this great ability to make you think like your position was under threat, even if it wasn't.
Like how?
Well, he'd call you out in a meeting and say, this isn't good enough. You know, if you're not going to do it, I've got other players here who will do it. Could be training on a Tuesday afternoon and, you know, the team's not selected until that night. You make a couple of mistakes, he says, well, get out, he'll put the next guy in. You know, little things like that. And that's the art of good coaching. It's the art of good management to be able to get the best out of people and to avoid that.
Might there have been an element, particularly in your earlier years, and, you know, you're openly honest about, you know, you had a certain element of cockiness. You described yourself earlier as a pup. At least that's how you would have been seen by other guys. You touched on this in your memoir as well. You were seen as somehow privileged. And I suppose, you know, you went to Clongowes Wood College, a great rugby school, but, you know, it would be seen as a kind of a mark of privilege to be able to go there. Your dad, a member of Royal County Down Golf Club. I mean, if there are two institutions...
Oh, you're pulling out all the stops now, Sean.
On this island, that sort of say, wow, you know, I mean, you have it made. Like, where golf is concerned and where rugby is concerned, like, that's purely an accident of birth. I mean, you can't be blamed for where you went to school or whatever. But would there have been an element in the coach's mind, this guy needs to be taken down a peg, or, you know, he's had it, maybe too much of it has been handed to him on a plate?
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation to make. You know, you never choose your own background and what way your formative years happen for you. But you take the likes of Michael Checa now, who did it the hard way. He was a rough Aussie who had to carve out his own path in life. And it's a fair point to make that if some people get a little bit easy in life, but just because, you know, you name off a private education secondary school and some elements of a privileged upbringing doesn't mean that I had it all easy. You know, I certainly didn't for a huge amount of years growing up. Perception and reality can be very different sometimes.
You talked about being bullied as a kid in primary school and being picked on. And then you were really glad to get away from that local scene and get to boarding school. You didn't feel able to talk about it at home. Like, would that have, again, with your own sense of maybe needing to bottle up, would that have been related? And I don't want to kind of intrude on territory that you don't want me to go into. But, you know, there was the family tragedy, the loss of your brother, your older brother, Ross, just in a terrible car accident. He just killed crossing the road. I mean, did you feel you maybe owed it to your parents not to add to their concerns?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you always, you know, it's funny as a parent now, your only remit in life is to protect your children. And that's all that you want to do. But I suppose when I was very young at the time, the only thing I wanted to do was to protect them from having to deal with more issues. I never spoke to them about it. You know, I think the first time they knew about it was when it came out in the book. Very Irish male thing to bottle things up, to not speak about anything, even though I was a young kid. Mm. There was that element of embarrassment talking about it as a kid as well. It still happens across so many schoolyards across our country. You know, you throw in social media now and the impacts that is having on young people, kids, early teenagers across the country. I think it's a real, real issue. And, you know, there should be absolutely nothing to warrant it. And I think schools need to get better at dealing with it. Parents need to get better at understanding it. They need an absolute no tolerance for this. Because
Did you see much of it in boarding school?
No, very little. Very little of it in boarding school.
There's another coach that we haven't mentioned so far. The one you had in Clongowes, a guy called Adam Lewis, I think. Another Aussie. He taught you a few things.
He taught me more than I'd ever know, I think. And more than I could really appreciate at the time. Adam was a great rugby coach. He had a great rugby brain. He was so far ahead of his time. He could without doubt be a professional rugby coach now if that was a path that he chose in life. But he was someone who was instilled in terms of that Jesuit education, the ethos of the school. You know, having good values as a person was something that was number one for him. And, you know, we were 16, 17, 18. These are big years in terms of forming you as a person, forming you as an adult. And, You know, he was a good person, but he really cared about creating good men when they leave Clongowes.
The example you cite in an open, and it doesn't reflect well on you, other than in your ability to be honest. He came in and he found you standing behind his desk one evening.
Yeah, so he was our prefect. So he, you know, our bedrooms were only 5-10 meters from his office, and he was the rugby coach at the time, and I was very close to him. We got on well, and you know, we had a big game on a Saturday afternoon. I think it was only in fourth year, so I was still very young. And I was curious about the team at the weekend. I saw he was out of his office and a little blank piece of paper on it with the first 15 names down on it. So I went into the office. I had a little glance, number 15, Rob Kearney, happy days. And then he came back into the office. He said, what are you doing? I said, nothing, just waiting to speak to you. And then the conversation went on a couple of minutes. And I said, I see him playing fullback at the weekend. Mother of God, he hit the roof. Hit the roof. So I didn't play 15 that week. And I didn't play 15 the following week either. So that's 2 weeks. But then there's, you know, much bigger lessons than that in terms of, you know, respect, honesty, privacy, so many different things than just glancing at a piece of paper. And that's what I mean about him being more concerned about creating good people as opposed to, you know, good rugby players.
How do you think your lifetime in rugby, schoolboy and then professional, up to fairly recently, like 2.5-3 years ago, has prepared you for the rest of your life?
I think very well. Okay, I'm hugely blessed and grateful for the time that I did spend in the sport, but you learn a huge amount of life lessons by being a part of those environments that you'll take with you forever. And one son now, I'd be very, very disappointed if he didn't play a team sport. I think it's so important for people. You know, the softer skills of life that I find now a lot of people take for granted out there in the workplace, turning up on time, doing what you say you're going to do, being able to deal with the setback, not getting too flustered if something doesn't go your way, finding a solution to a problem. You know, and sports people, professional sports people who have been in that high performance environment for so long have all of these skills in spades. And I think rugby players, particularly when they retire and they come out of the sport and they're looking for what to do next, where's my next job going to be? They undersell those skills that they have. Okay, they might not have used a computer before. They can't use Excel or Word or all of these fancy computer things, but they have an enormous amount of skills to offer.
You have stated that professional sports people can be incredibly selfish. That's just part of what you have to do. How would that manifest itself, say, in the way you would treat people close to you?
You know, you say that sports people can be incredibly selfish. I'd change that again now and I'd say sports people have to be incredibly selfish. I was always very unapologetic about it. You know, this is how I have to be if I want to get the very best of myself. You know, and it's more family and friends who bear the brunt of that. You know, you're missing big events, you're not spending as much time with them. You're always putting yourself before other people. But like I say, when you have a higher purpose, when there's somewhere you want to go, you don't want to let anything get in the way of you achieving that.
What about the highs, the good days when, you know, you're leaving the Millennium Stadium and you've just landed our first Grand Slam in 61 years? I mean, that must be something absolutely amazing. How long does it stay with you when you have a high like that?
The highs never leave you, Sean. You know, so some of the big ones like that, I'll take that to my grave with me. I really will. You know, those first few days after it, that one was probably the most special of all the days because the history that was attached to it, the nature of the game, Ron McGarrah's last minute drop goal. You know, we came home to Dublin the following day and the country was at a standstill. You know, there was thousands of people on Dawson Street. It had that Italian 90 vibe to it for a couple of days within the country. So, you know, I will always remember that as being one of the great days. But you go back on a training field 4 or 5 days later and, you know, Michael Cech, who was the Leinster coach at the time says, I don't care what any of you have done for Ireland, what you've achieved. This is a new team now. We've got new goals. We've a new trophy we have to go and get. And anyone who wants to live in last week can get lost.
You had some special days with the Lions as well. And perhaps one of the better ones was that you played really well on a day that the team was beaten.
Yeah.
And you had just come back from, I mean, like you had been terribly sick with mumps and all the rest of it.
I was very sick, yeah. And me participating in that Lions tour was actually touch and go at the time. I spent 10 days in Black Rock Clinic. I'd lost a load of weight. This was only 2.5 months out, 2 months out from the Lions tour. And I remember I went back training after 5 weeks. Did my first session, I think it lasted 7 minutes before I was in the toilets getting sick. So my preparation up to that Lions tour was non-existent. I was lucky to have made it. You know, other coaches at the time could have pulled you out and put in some fitter guys. But I think that second test on the Lions tour was one game which really put me on the world rugby map. You have these days, I don't know if you're a golfer or whatever sport some
poor
people
one.
Play, you have these days where everything you do just works. You're in a flow. You can't do anything wrong. And that was one of those days for me. Mind you, I haven't had too many of them in my career, but what a time to have it on the biggest of stages. I've played better games of rugby since then, you know, where I've contributed more to the team or my overall play has been better. But I think given the occasion, the performance on that day, I'll put it down as one of the best performances I've ever had, certainly.
There was also the day in Chicago when, again, you were very uncertain going into that match in your own head. Then just to sort of make matters worse, as it were, Joe Schmidt has a word in your ear as you're heading out the dressing room door against the All Blacks.
I was rock bottom then, despite that I'd been in the national team for 7-8 years. My body had given way on me. My form then as a result of that wasn't particularly good. And the media had really started to turn on me. The public had started to turn on me. And so it was a lonely time. And I remember the night before the game, we always have, as a team, have access to sports psychologists. They travel with us. And I never really liked to use them too much. I was always a player who preferred to be able to master and come to terms with my own head and not necessarily letting another voice in there to make me rethink and re-question. I always felt if I can master this myself, well, then that's going to be the best thing for me. So the night before the game, Enda McNulty was with the team at the time. I said, Enda, I need to meet you for a cup of tea downstairs. So went for a cup of tea at around 8:30, 9:30. I didn't break down because I was playing a test match the next day. So you still have to be unbelievably on it mentally. And I was just saying, it's just not happening for me. Everything's going wrong. Everyone's turning on me. My body's still not a little bit great. I'm just waiting for a spark. You know, that's all I need. And I'm just hoping that it comes tomorrow. And it was so simple, his reply, but it lasted with me. And he just looked me in the eye and said, just make the spark yourself. Just do it. And listen, when I say that, repeat it back now to you, it sounds so remedial. But it's what I needed to hear it.
He flicked a switch.
He flicked a switch inside my head, yeah. And, you know, where I was so obsessed with waiting for this lucky break or for something to happen for me, just go and do it yourself. Grab the neck and just make something happen. So that was fine. I was feeling good again. I was back up on top that evening. Okay, I'm going to go and make something happen. Next day, the bus to the stadium, I remember sitting beside Andrew Trimble on it. And I said, if there was a plane back to Dublin now, I would get on it. I did not want to get off this team bus and go and play another test against New Zealand where the chances are we're going to get beaten again. You know, if we lose, the chances are again that I'm going to be the fella that the people go after because I've been playing poorly and everything's been going wrong and the coach isn't man enough to put in. I think it was Tiernan O'Halloran at the time who was playing really good rugby for Munster, and he was breathing down my neck. And 5-10 minutes before kickoff, Joe pulls me aside, and Joe was good before you run out for the anthems. He'd always, you know, he might have had a go at you during the week, but that was his moment to big you back up again. And he would always say to me, big players perform on the big days and you're a big player, so today's your day. And it's nice when the coach says that to you. It's, you know, fills you up a little bit. The shoulders go back a little bit more. So I was waiting for this line that he normally gives me. And he looks me deadpan in the eye and says, you need a big game today.
Ooh.
I was furious. I was thinking, you know that I'm struggling now. You know that my body's not great. You know that everyone's on my back. And you've just heaped more pressure on me. So I cursed him for the first minute. And then the second minute, you think, okay, well, the game starts soon. You've no choice but to try and turn this around. What are you going to do to get yourself out of the hole? And then the third minute comes around. It's, okay, this is your last chance. You have to give everything you have, take the shackles off. If you're going to go out in this game, if this is going to be a turning point for you, go out with a fight. And then once you get in the field, you know, everything goes, you're in your happy place then. You're not thinking about what was said. And the first involvement in the game is always really important. And a lot of that time can be down to a bounce of a ball or a little bit of luck.
Did he give you a wink or arm around the shoulder when it was all over? I mean, like, you were the guy that was kind of pushed out to talk to the media in the aftermath of that performance.
Yeah, he did. And he I remember after the game, he said, I knew you had it in you. And it was in some ways, it was a little bit counterproductive to the remainder of my career, because he then always thought that I was a person who needed that kick up the backside and who needed a little bit more extreme pressure put on him, because he felt that this was what worked to get the best out of me.
The cattle prod.
Yeah. So I was prodded by him a fair few times after that.
I'm just wondering, I mean, like, you finished up your rugby career, I think, playing for the Barbarians. And then literally 5 days later, you headed off to, was it Doon Bay, to marry the love of your life? I mean, was that a case of just looking for another high, you know, as quick as you could after finishing with rugby?
Yes, it's amazing how, you know, you can play a professional rugby career of 17 years. And the day I retired, you know, 5 days later, you're walking down the aisle getting married. So in some respects, it was beautiful timing to close one massive chapter in your life and then start another big chapter. Family life has now become my biggest purpose since the rugby days. And, you know, I spoke about, you know, been very lucky from a young age to have that purpose. This is exactly where I want to go. And when I retired, replacing that was my biggest fear. Am I ever going to have the same drive to get me out of bed every single day where there's something I know this is where I want to go? And the recent birth of my son has been amazing for that. You know, starting a family, now been a dad.
Another high. Were you there?
I was there. I certainly was. There was no way I was missing that. Listen, it was the high of all highs. And I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, but discussing our wedding day with Jess is always, listen, she thinks this was the best day of her life. You know, nothing will come close to her wedding day. It was the best day of my life. I loved it. I'd love to redo it, everything again. In my own head, I'm thinking, Jesus, this doesn't come into the top 10 days of my life. I've had Heineken Cups, Grand Slams, beaten the All Blacks. Our wedding day doesn't even register.
Careful now.
And I thought that nothing would ever come close to some of these big victories. But the birth of your first child has made all of those sporting days so insignificant.
It's almost as though, sorry to cut across you, you're like witnessing a little piece of creation happening before your eyes.
It's in some ways, it's hard to articulate it. It is the most amazing. It's miraculous. It's so special. There's a drug in it. There's a little bit of a drug. You're like, I want to go and do that again.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you would hope he will play a team sport. Would you have any concerns about young Bobby turning to rugby, I mean, given what we've witnessed, you obviously were very, very fortunate in the sense that you never had any serious head injuries. But I remember interviewing Fergus Slattery for around the time he was 70 a few years ago. And I was wondering, well, you know, on the 50th anniversary of that famous time England came to Lansdowne Road during the Troubles and Ireland won. And it was a start of a huge respect between those teams and a bond between the unions and supporters and so forth. Thinking he'd be showing up for that. But by then, he had, and David Walsh has written about this. I mean, dementia has intervened in his life, and it's kind of traced back to rugby injuries and clashes of heads. Would you have those kind of concerns about your own kid?
Listen, I think, you know, we're still in this little bit of limbo in terms of rugby and the head collisions and some of those concussions that players have had over the last 20, 30 years of playing the game. Time will tell over the next 10, 15, what impact that has had on some people, the likes of Fergus. I think rugby is a far safer game than it was back then. It's a far safer game now than it was when I started out, with directly concerning to head injuries and concussions and how teams, medics, coaches, the governing body look after players in terms of that. It's a tough game. It's players are getting bigger, they're getting stronger. The collisions are only going to get bigger. So there is going to be injuries. That's just the nature of the game. If he didn't play it, I wouldn't be overly disappointed by it. And equally, if he wanted to play it, I think great, because there is, it can develop good people. The values of the game are very, very strong. Now you could make huge arguments for and against both cases.
So you went off to Doonbeg to get married. Donald Trump's Irish Bolt Hall. I mean, what did Joe Biden make of that when he heard about it?
It's very nasty if you know, Sean, bringing up that one. I suspect Joe Biden knew nothing about it. Listen, it was a special place for Jess. It's where she wanted to get married. I didn't have much of a say in it.
Men seldom do on these matters. But speaking of Joe Biden, you are a distant relation, I think 6 or 7 cousin. We've just seen a fair bit of him. I mean, particularly when he was in Ireland last spring.
Yeah, I've seen a fair bit of him over the course of the last few years. Listen, Sean, you know yourself, when you're blood related, you're blood related. You know, you can't let these relationships slip. Obviously, I say that fully in jest. Yeah, it's a bizarre set of circumstances, how it happened, how it's come around. I've no problem saying I'm firmly on the bandwagon. I'm living off it, spending lots of time in the White House, multiple occasions. When he came to Ireland only a few months ago, was there to welcome him and show him around Carlingford and Dundalk.
Did you get to travel in the Beast, that great big vehicle?
I was in, well, there's a few Beasts. I wasn't in his Beast, but there was a few behind them. The weight of the doors, honestly, it took 2 Secret Service lads to actually open them up. I was meant to travel down in Air Force One with him. Marine One, which is the helicopter, not the big plane. He was coming from Dublin down to Cooley, but the storms were up that day, so I had to settle for my own car. You know, he's a good man, despite what you think about his politics and what's going on in the world at the moment. He is a man whose moral compass is very much pointing in the right way. He is a man who...
But here's the question now. Somebody who mixes up the All Blacks with the Black and Tans, do you think there's an issue about whether he is right mentally?
Listen, there's no doubt that he's getting on in age. And if there's one job in the world that's going to age you, that is it. You know, does he want to run again? I suspect probably not. He'd love to sign out after, you'd have to say, a very good term. But the opinion in the Democrats is that he's the only man that can take on Trump, rightly or wrongly. And the two of them will go head to head, battle again. At the moment, it's not looking good. I think the American people are probably blinded a little bit by the levels of inflation they have at the moment. Biden has had a pretty good term. He's done a lot of really good things for their country. But the world we're living in now, with misinformation and fake news and propaganda and one news channel just spitting out their narrative, it's testing times, you know. So the result of that, what way it goes, is concerning for a lot of people. And it should be concerning for us as Irish too, because I don't think we fully appreciate having him in the White House, how good it is for this country. And if Trump gets in, you know, we won't be able to call on that relationship and some of the benefits we get from it.
Did politics ever cross your mind as a possible career?
Not in the slightest. I think it's one of the hardest jobs in the country. When the bin man comes and takes your bin during the week, you look at him and you say, thanks very much. You know, politicians never get that, regardless of the job they're doing. They're always on the back foot. They can never do enough. No, you would not in a month of Sundays.
You've been in the limelight. You're now in retirement, in early retirement, in the sporting sense, a pundit for Virgin Media's coverage, which is shared with RTE. Six Nations. I mean, how long can it stay as good as it has been, you know, for Ireland, you know, in that setting?
Why can't it stay forever? You know, if you take the psychology of New Zealand people, you know, they expect to be number one every single year. Why can't we do that? Why can't we have this expectation that our rugby team is always going to be up there at the top?
And yet, when it comes to the World Cup, it happens again, as it did recently. We finish at the quarterfinal stage. Johnny Sexton took a bit of stick for suggesting, look, we lost, but we won. What are your own reflections on that?
I think it's been taken out of context a little bit. That quote was a representation of inspiring a nation. Of course, we lost the World Cup. And not to get past another quarterfinal is a big loss. And this was the team that should have done it, the best team that we've ever sent to a World Cup. And they come back with another quarterfinal loss. I think the impact that the rugby team had on the nation during the World Cup was enormous. You know, the country really got behind them. We saw in droves how many people travelled to Paris week in, week out. This Irish rugby supporting community was the heartbeat of the World Cup. And our rugby team does inspire a lot of people. It does. People get behind it. The sport has this amazing ability where, regardless of what is going on in your life, when that whistle starts, you're just fully in the game and nothing else matters.
You were doing a bit of punditry recently ahead of the Six Nations and suggesting that Andy Farrell would choose somebody as Irish captain who would basically be the captain heading into the next World Cup. Hasn't turned out like that. Were you surprised he went for Peter O'Mahony?
I was a little bit surprised. Peter is a great captain and he's always going to be very vocal when he's on the field. I thought this was a good opportunity to blood your next captain, to have him play alongside Peter for the Six Nations, to be able to learn from him, but to take on that mantle, it's not an easy job. I did it for Leinster. I think the first time I did it, I was 32. I was playing for the province for 13 years. I was a very experienced player, but it still had a big impact on me in terms of my nerves going into the game. You're now having to think about team decisions that you would never normally have to think about. Do we go for the corner? Do we take the three? Building a relationship with the referee, how to speak to the referee, when to speak to the referee. These are skills that have to be developed over a period of time. And I thought that for the next World Cup, we need to have a captain who has had that role for a long period of time. But maybe he doesn't know who his next captain is going to be. And I think, you know, the decision to go with Peter probably insinuates that he doesn't know who his next captain is going to be, and he's still waiting to see it.
Time will tell. Meanwhile, enjoy your new life as a pundit, and family life as well, clearly, is something that appeals to you. Thank you so much indeed for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Sean, thanks for having me, and great to be here. Thank you.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.